What's it like to be a Mexican restaurant owner in this political climate?
They were really concerned, and they have a little shipping business, and they said that they've had customers who have been little by little sending things back home. Boxes of clothes, toys, so that they had to flee, that they would have something waiting for them once they went back to Mexico.
That's Chicago Tribune food reporter Luisa Chu. She joins us along with a Mexican restaurant owner to talk about concerns from the Mexican-American community ever since President Trump took office. Plus, graduating from college is becoming more and more difficult for people who have to take out student loans.
You can take a loan and still not be able to cover your bills, which leads you to work such long hours. It pushes you out of college.
Higher ed policy expert Sarah Goldrick-Rabb and Senator Dick Durbin weigh in, along with a recent college grad from the University of Illinois. And as we do every Monday, we bring you the latest in politics. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Ever since President Trump took office in January, we've heard concern from various immigrant communities across the country. And here in Chicago, Mexican restaurant owners all over the city have been hearing their fair share of concerns about what's next, whether it's from their families, customers, or employees. That includes a lot of uncertainty about the future, including the fact that some Mexicans and Mexican Americans have started shipping items back to Mexico. Others have been holding off on big expenses like fixing their cars because they don't know where they're going to be living in a few months. What does it mean to be a Mexican restaurant owner right now? That was the question on Chicago Tribune food reporter Luisa Chu's mind as she went around to various restaurants across the city. She's in studio with me now, along with Samita Puebla restaurant owner Tony Antilles. He has three restaurants across the city. Luisa, Tony, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much, both of you, for being here.
Thank you, Nyla.
Nyla, thank you for having me.
Tony, let me start with you. I wonder how you feel like the mood has changed in your restaurants since January, since President Trump took office.
It's definitely a thing. You hear about it a lot, just from the employee chatter, the boys, my prep guys are always have the radio on, almost like a morning zoo radio show in Spanish. And that's the topic every day. So it's unavoidable. I think a lot of the boys are at least my staff, they tend to joke about it. But I think it is a concern, it's an uncertainty right now. And it's something that's never, I've never heard talked about this much. You always hear whispers of it. And it's always a worry when family and friends come over to this country and some of them, don't have the ability to come over the right way. And they're just looking to make a better life for their family back at home or their family here. It's always a risk. But now, more than ever, I think you just don't stop hearing about it.
Luisa, what gave you the idea to do this story?
I was actually lucky that I was assigned the story. My editors at the Tribune, we wanted to do a story for the food section as part of our immigration series at the Tribune. And so we knew we wanted to do something that related to food, immigration, and then also we happened to be in the middle of our Mexican Food Month where we had a chance to explore all sorts of different Mexican restaurants. And so we talked about it and tried to figure out how we were going to approach this since, as a journalist, I can't discuss politics, especially in the food section. We wanted to make this relevant. And so I presented this idea of, why don't we look at how this is, affecting Mexican restaurant owners. I mean, we hear a lot about the fears, but some of our most beloved Mexican food is made by successful Mexican restaurant owners. And Tony just happens to be one of them who's got and it was an excuse to go to Tony's restaurant a whole bunch of times, really. And I just want to point out, having had a chance to do that, you have not only boys and girls, but ladies who work in your restaurant and who run all three of them extremely well. So,
thank you so much.
It was an excuse to go out and eat great food.
No wonder she was there 14 days straight.
She was there 14 at all three locations, yeah. Right? Because you've got three locations in the West Loop, in Logan Square, and Hyde Park. So all over the city of Chicago. I wonder, Tony, what Luisa said, though, as a journalist, she's not talking about politics. And I wonder how you guys have handled that because you're running a business. But it's not just politics. This is a very personal thing for a lot of people, too.
Of course. My parents have been in this country going on almost 45, 50 years. My four siblings, we were all born here. My folks met in the late 60s. They got married. And, you know, you constantly have, you know, family and friends that all of a sudden arrive one day, you know, and you didn't know about. But, you know, they and all of them, just like my parents, just came here for, you know, to make a better living for their kids and give us the opportunity. And, you know, my folks were big believers in the, and they still are, in the American dream, you know, working hard, putting your head down and going about your business. And any problem you have, the answer is always work harder. The work will solve everything. So my parents really bought into that. So, and most of my family did. But it's, you know, it's always looking over your shoulder, kind of.
Yeah, and I wondered is that something? Do you hear that from customers? Do you hear that from workers? That they feel like maybe, I don't want to say that the immigrant story or the narrative has changed, mm-hmm. but do they feel like things are different now?
Like, you know, sometimes you'll hear from customers. Sometimes again, almost joke, but at the same time, you know, you understand that almost sometimes with all kinds of humor, there's truth under there that underlies it. So, you know, when they'll joke about it, like, you know, this will be the last time you'll see me, you know, like, I mean, come on, you know, don't say that. But it is, I'd say, a sincere worry, you know, where, you know, so much rhetoric is being put out there and that, you know, and it feels like, you know, we were taking two steps forward and now we feel like we're taking two steps back.
And do you feel like the opposite is also true, that more people are coming out to support you because they feel like maybe if they're not Latino or whatever, that they want to show their support for the immigrant community? Have you heard that from people?
Our customers have always been awesome. You know, we've been open for about 14 years. But I'd say the last 8 years, my customer base went from being almost predominantly like 95% Mexican. And then when we kind of got in this role, we were very blessed. And I had people from all walks of life.
Right now, you're in the West Loop, which is, you know, the most fashionable place to have a restaurant in the city.
And it's an awesome neighborhood to be in. But, like, you know, our original spot in Humboldt Park, or our one in Logan Square. Or, you know what? No, and even the one in the West Loop. Yeah, our first few months, it was definitely West Loopy, if that's a thing.
Right.
But now, again, just because our customers are so devoted and so great in the West Loop, which, you know what the West Loop looks like. Like, some of my neighbors, you can walk
into
the restaurant.
It's very trendy. Right.
But what I've always been proud of, and what I'm proud of, you know, still to this day, is walk into my restaurant on a Sunday afternoon and you're going to see your Mexican family. You're going to see, quote-unquote, a hipster. Then you'll see a post-college graduate. Then you'll see a police officer. And then you'll see maybe a landscaper. And I've always been really proud of it. We did that in Humboldt Park. We're doing it in Logan Square. And it took a little while to do it in the West Loop, because sometimes people don't know that you're there. But a lot of times, you know, there tend to be a lot of Mexicans on the South Side, and that's the one closest to them. But once word got out that, you know, we had opened in the West Loop, and that's a great feeling, you know, you want to do that in the West Loop, you know, that you're able to – you're the one spot on there. You know, not the one spot, but you're one of the few spots that's able to have all walks of life sitting at the dining room at once.
That's Tony Antilles. He's the owner of Semitas Puebla. We're talking about Mexican restaurant owners throughout Chicago, how they've reacted to President Trump and being in office, changes to our immigration policy. Luisa, so that's Tony's perspective, especially as someone who's been around for a while, has three restaurants across the city. I wonder, is it different in parts of the city like Pilsen that are predominantly Mexican, parts of the South Side or the West Side where there might be more Central Americans? Like, do you feel like it's a different story where some people might be worried about ICE raids and things like that? Mm-hmm. You're nodding your head.
Yeah, for sure. Vigorously, I'm nodding my head. And that was one of the big things when I was really trying to figure out how to tell the story through the eyes of the Mexican restaurant community, was that there's been a lot of stories about how businesses in Little Village are, you know, really afraid. But as Tony mentions, it really varies depending on the location and time of day sometimes too. So, for example, one of the restaurants that I visited, which is located in Little Village, oh boy, and I totally am blanking right now on the name of La Chaparrita, of course. Right. Voted as one of the best taco places in Chicago. Angelina Mendez, who is the owner there, was talking about actually speaking in Spanish through a translator who herself is trying to go through the Dreamers Act program right now. They were really concerned, and they were saying actually that they not only have a wonderful restaurant, they also have a little shop next door, actually attached, and they have a little shipping business. And they said that they've had customers who have been little by little sending things back home. boxes of clothes, toys, so that they had to flee, that they would have something waiting for them once they went back to Mexico. And so they're really worried about ICE raids. And they were talking about how they have seen customers, you know, that are predominantly of Mexican heritage just not coming back. And they were saying that since the election that they have really seen over the years, certainly there's been a change, as Tony's mentioning, in, you know, customer base and exposure. But that what's really helped their businesses is actually what they were calling people of mixed races, not only Mexican background, but and when I was sitting there, I heard actually somebody say that they were there because they saw a Tribune story. And then one of our former colleagues was mentioning that they were there because they heard somebody mention La Chaparrita on our Chewing podcast. And so everybody can help support the businesses, because not only for political reasons, but for food reasons, too.
And I wonder, Tony, I don't know if you ever talk to restaurant owners outside of Chicago, if you feel like it's different outside the city of Chicago. Louisa, I wonder for you too. Like, Chicago has been very vocal about, Mayor Emanuel has been very vocal about, this is a sanctuary city. We immigrants are an important part of our economy. We stand with them. You know, Mayor Emanuel's been very vocal about that. And, you know, we've seen that across the state. Other mayors, a few mayors have been very vocal about that. I'm thinking about the mayor of Rockford and Urbana. There are other towns where people have been deported. And like the Mexican, you know, there was a Mexican restaurant owner who was deported in a town in southern Illinois. And that whole town was, you know, was very upset. Yeah. You know, they just were like, we didn't want him to go. When we said we wanted immigrants to leave, we didn't mean him.
Right. It's a thing, though. It's like, you know, you want it, but you have to be careful what you ask for.
Do you think, Louisa, I don't know, what do you guys think about outside of Chicago? Do you think it's a different environment?
No. Well, you know, I don't know, with that other story maybe a few weeks back where, you know, the agents came in and sat down and had breakfast. Mm-hmm. And then they even complimented the restaurant owner or the chef. This is great. And then they took someone away from the same restaurant. Mm-hmm. It's like, oh, my goodness. And that was outside of Chicago. I think Indiana, I could be mistaken, but still, that's just, you know.
These are stories people in the community are talking
right,
about.
Right, of course, yeah. You know, I read it online, and then, like, one of the guys was talking about it at work, and then he started talking about it with customers, and, you know, like, you know. We have a lot of law enforcement that comes through, and all of them are really cool and really nice, and I've known a lot of them for years, and they're really good customers. You know, just you develop really good relationships with them. But I was, you know, you start thinking, well, what do next time they compliment us, you know, and they start asking, you know, questions about our customers or about our employees. But no, Chicago's been, you know, like you said, from the on top, from the mayor and the restaurant owners, and at least, you know, you hear positiveness coming out of mm-hmm. those fronts, I think, compared to other places.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Louisa, do you think there has been an economic impact, though, on the city when we think about the restaurant community?
That's definitely what I had heard from some of the other restaurant owners. For example, over at El Patron, just a little technically in Logan Square, but they kind of have more of a Hermosa feel. They're a little bit farther west. They were talking about the fact that they own three businesses, not only El Patron, but also a auto repair shop and a liquor store. And that businesses definitely dropped. And, you know, that they're not that concerned yet. But, you know, definitely at all the restaurants that I spoke with for this story, as well as outside of this, that everybody's okay right now because, again, these are particularly successful businesses. But if it continues to drop, especially through the summer, where normally we see a big surge in business, then that becomes a big concern. I mean, Tony, we talked about this too. And, we talked in the middle of, it's hard to believe, in like the middle of winter.
Right.
And, you know, that's a typically slow time. But if it continues right. as a trend, I mean, because it's maybe hard to believe that we're only a few months into this new administration, that could have a significant impact.
Yeah, do you worry about a long-term? And I wonder for both of you, I mean, for you, Tony, it doesn't sound like there's been much of an economic impact, but I wonder what you think, how this, if there might be an effect on the food landscape of not just Chicago, but we think outside of Illinois or even across the country, we think about immigrant restaurants.
Well, yeah. When you talk about especially Mexican immigrants, that affects restaurants not only from the customer perspective, but also from the helping perspective and from the ownership perspective, from the cook perspective, from the dishwasher perspective, from the food runner, you know. recently, and I don't know if this correlates. You know, one of the things that I was telling Lisa a little earlier is that I've been having a hard time finding back of the house help lately.
Mm, so you've been having a hard time.
Yeah, you know, and we've gone different, you know, through different vehicles to try to find help. You know, Facebook, Craigslist, Twitter, and you know, Spanish and English. And normally, and this was 5 years ago, if I put one thing out on Facebook, I kid you not, I'd have 100 calls the next day. You know, and recently, I don't know, is it due to that, or is it due to the saturation of so many restaurants right now in Chicago, or is it just, you know, a combination of both? It's just, it's weird times right now, for sure.
Lisa, we just have about a minute left. I wonder your perspective as someone who has covered food in the city, you've covered food and restaurants all over the world. What do you think the impact is? Would you worry about a long-term impact?
Absolutely. I mean, again, it's, as I was saying, it's hard to believe that we've only been in this for a few months and that we're starting to see this now. And while I was doing the story, I really wanted to frame it as, let's not fan fears unfoundedly. But these plans, because there's not been a lot of concrete changes that have been made yet. How are they affecting people? They're affecting people now. And we're just starting to see this now on our plates, and how that's going to affect us long term is definitely something that we have to prepare for, which is what I was seeing. But it's also been very hopeful, which has been fantastic. And speaking with Tony's dad, who, when I asked him if he was concerned about traveling himself, he said, nope, I got nothing to be afraid of.
That's Louisa Chu. She's a Chicago Tribune food reporter. You can also catch her on her with her podcast, Chewing. We will tweet out a link to her story. And I want to thank Louisa and, of course, Tony Antilles.
Thank you.
Samitas Puebla, three different locations if you're in Chicago. Thanks so much for being with me, too, Tony.
Well, thank you.
Thank you, Nyla.
Thanks for tuning into The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Student debt stands at $1.4 trillion in the U.S. That's more than both auto and credit card loans. We know it's a problem. We also know that college is the key to having a job that can help you pay off those loans, because college graduates still, on average, make more than those who have just a high school degree. But what happens to people who have college debt and they don't graduate? A new study has some troubling information. It shows that just 55% of students with federal loans graduate within 6 years at the average private nonprofit college. At public universities, the rate's even lower. It's 46%. We're going to tweet out more information on that. Our handle is 21STShow. In a minute, we're going to be joined by a higher education policy expert and a recent grad who can tell us more about student debt. But first, I caught up with Illinois Senior Senator Dick Durbin last week. He's been criticizing President Donald Trump's proposed budget in part because it would slash funding for student aid and work-study jobs. Senator Durbin has also introduced legislation that he says would help people with student loan debt. And I asked him, out of those, what he thought was the most pressing on this issue right now.
$1.3 trillion in student loan debt in America, 41 million people who owe the money, average indebtedness $30,000. For some, it's dramatically more. We now have more student loan debt than credit card debt. We have a situation where the president's budget will make it worse in two or three specific ways. The president freezes Pell Grants, which is not a loan but a grant, and as he freezes those grants and the cost of education goes up, students have to borrow more money. Secondly, for the first time, we are going to be imposing interest cost on students while they're still in school. We basically said if you're still actively involved in school, we're not going to start the clock running, the meter running, in terms of the interest you have to pay. The Trump budget changes that, and it means the indebtedness of current students is going to grow while they are in school. If it takes them 5 years, they, by the time they graduate, will have 5 years of accumulated interest debt on their loan. I brought that up with Betsy DeVos. I said, this doesn't make it any easier, and the administration doesn't support the efforts we are trying to undertake here with Senator Elizabeth Warren for people to consolidate their loans, which folks do every day. Now, keep in mind, the vast majority of student loans are debts owed by individuals and families to the federal government. So the people making the policy about the repayment of the loans are the folks working at Betsy DeVos's Department of Education and the president.
That was Senator Dick Durbin. I spoke with him last week talking about student loans. We're now joined by Sarah Goldrick-Rabb, a professor of higher education policy at Temple University, and Jean Kang, a recent graduate from the University of Illinois. Sarah's on the line from Temple, Jean from her home in Des Plaines. Sarah, Jean, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Jean, let's start with you. Congratulations. You just graduated from the University of Illinois. What did you study?
I studied broadcast journalism.
All right, great. Well, good. You're starting your career out well in public radio. How many federal loans, Jean, did you have to take out to go to the U of I?
I took out roughly around $30,000 in loans, in federal loans.
And did you get state MAP grant funding as well?
I got, yes, I got a good amount of grants because of my parents' situation. So I got the I don't know specifically which grants I got, but I know I got the Pell Grant, the MAP Grant, and I think I got some other grants as well.
Mm-hmm. So it sounds like both federal and state grant funding. And then did you have student jobs also when you were working to help pay for your education?
I did for a little bit. My situation is different because I come from an Asian background, and with Asian immigrant parents, they really focus on education rather than working by myself and paying off the tuition, because they know in the long run that will help me get a better job. So in the beginning of my undergrad, I did work off working at the dining hall to try to pay off my tuition and any other stuff that I need to pay off. But then later in the future, as my classes became more rigorous and I wanted to focus more on my studies, my parents gave me an allowance and told me that I shouldn't work, that I should focus on my studies.
Hmm. And you're the first in your family to go to college too, right, Jean?
Yes. So they really did focus on me maintaining a high GPA, me maintaining a good relationship with my studies and school rather than working.
Yeah. And did you graduate within 4 years, right, Jean?
Yes, I did.
Professor, I wanted to bring you into this conversation. Is Jean's story a typical one, you think? I don't know if there is a typical story for undergraduate U.S. college students and loans these days.
Well, there are certainly some common themes in the stories of today's students. And yes, I mean, to some extent, her story resonates with the story of students who are able and fortunate enough to have parents who are able to provide them with at least some support. You know, as you can hear, she qualified for several grant programs that are reserved for students whose families don't make a lot. And it's great that we do provide that support. But the first thing that your listeners should really take note of is that even though she qualified for the federal Pell Grant, which is a program that was supposed to cover 100% of the cost of attending college if you went to a public institution, she nonetheless still had to take on student debt. And that is a huge change over time. That represents a program failure, frankly. In that, you know, these are students who we know need to go to college. She needs that degree. So does her family. And she shouldn't have had to take out the debt in the first place. Moreover.
Why has that changed over time?
Mm-hmm. Well, look, I mean, one of the biggest reasons it's changed over time is that as more people have gone to college, states and the federal government have not kept up their end of the bargain, which is to say that it used to be the case that if you went to college and your family didn't have much money, the state and the federal government together would cover a very large fraction of your cost of attending college. And over time, that fraction has dropped substantially. They are spending a lot of money, but they're not spending as much as they used to on a per-student basis, helping students out with the cost of college.
We're talking about student loan debt. My guest is Sarah Goldrick-Rabb. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. We've also been talking to a recent graduate, Jean Kang. She just graduated from the U of I this year, first in her family to go to college. She had federal student loans. Sarah, I wanted to ask you about that study because that we began this conversation with, that 55% of those who had federal loans had a hard time graduating in 6 years from private schools, and even less, 46% of them graduated within 6 years from public institutions. What did you think of that data?
Well, I mean, I think that it tells and points towards where the real story is here. The people who are most struggling to repay their student loans are not those, like Jean, who finished her degree and who you can hear is confident that she will find ways to repay that debt. the people who are most in pain didn't finish college at all. And one of the reasons that they don't finish college is that despite the fact that they took on debt, that loan didn't actually make it possible to sufficiently afford college. So it might surprise listeners to know that most students cannot borrow more than about $5,000 to $6,000 for their first year of college. But college prices are up in the 20s and 30s of thousands of dollars. So it means that you can take a loan and still not be able to cover your bills, which leads you to work such long hours that pushes you out of college. And now what you have is debt and no degree.
Sarah, do you have a sense that there's a whole generation of people out there who are in that situation? Do you think this is a significant number of the population? Do we know how big this is?
There are literally millions of people in this situation and more coming. They are in college facing prices they cannot afford, making untenable trade-offs, leaving behind their ambitions for a college education, and leaving and entering a workforce that doesn't have enough jobs for them. They are not only frustrated, but they're also increasingly angry. And I think it makes a lot of sense that they're angry, because they were told to go on to college after high school, and they were told that that investment would pay off for them. But we didn't keep our end of the bargain as society. We didn't give them the supports they had in K-12 education, where their tuition was free and there was even support for their families with food and housing. And there's going to be retribution. There's going to be a backlash. I think we're already seeing it from people who say, we don't trust the government. Because on one of the biggest, most important decisions of their lives, college, the government didn't come through.
I also wonder, it's a little bit of a catch-22 in a way too, right? Because if you don't have the money, then you probably need the extra support for college. And what you're saying is that's precisely what we're not providing.
That's exactly right. I mean, we're telling them that it will be there for them. But so many of them find out that their bills are so much more substantial than the financial aid that they get, that we're even documenting evidence that a growing number of college students today is struggling with even hunger or homelessness while taking on loans.
Sarah, what do you suggest for families that are thinking about college now? I mean, certainly you've offered policy solutions in terms of thinking about ways that policy solutions in terms of looking at, for example, the opposite of what President Trump is proposing. You've mentioned the cost of college. It's something certainly lots of universities have been paying attention to. How do you suggest families and, more importantly, young people approach this when they're thinking about their freshman year?
Well, I think they have to think about it very, very carefully and very realistically when it comes to their budget. So I think the first thing families need to do is to figure out what they can really afford. And they should assume that the prices that they're being told they will have to pay may even be higher than they look initially. When they're told they're going to get financial aid, they may end up getting less as the student goes through college, not more. When they're told that this will be the price of housing, they should add on to that because, as we know, rent rises over time. They need to look at what they can really afford for 4 or even 5 years of college, and then they should have the conversation about which college their student can attend. I think it's very hard that so many parents want to send their child to any school the child wishes to go to because they think it makes them a good parent for having done so. But putting that child into debt and giving themselves debt that they can't handle as a family, that's not a good way to start a young person off with their life. So I think a lot of families are unfortunately going to need to have conversations about making hard choices. They need to look at their nearby community college and figure out if that might be a good place to get the first couple years of education done. They might need to figure out with the student, maybe it makes sense to go to college closer at home and, you know, live at home while they're in school. They need to figure out if there are ways to make compromises so as to avoid not only the debt, you know, debt's not the enemy, but dropping out of college because you couldn't afford to stay, that's the problem they want to avoid.
Jean, as you're listening to Sarah talk about all of these, I wonder, you said your debt was about $30,000. Do you have friends, I imagine, who have a lot more who have graduated this year with a lot more debt than you did?
Yes. I have a good amount of friends who didn't receive as much grants as I did because their families are more well-off as me, and I have friends who are in $60,000, even $90,000 in debt. And I feel bad for them, but they did graduate from a prestigious university, and I'm confident that they will be able to pay it off.
And I guess that's the question, Sarah, for people who can't pay it off, if they don't have enough jobs, I mean, if they don't have a job that is able to support them in a way that they can pay off the debt, how does that also affect them financially in the long run in terms of, are we looking at also a generation of people affected by, I know that student debt factors different than other debt in terms of your credit rating, but I imagine that's still a problem as well. Sarah?
Yeah, it is an issue. I mean, I think that, you know, you are going to see people, again, making hard choices, some of whom are going to decide to postpone other purchases that they might have made earlier in their lives. Hopefully, some of the protections that the federal government has offered, things like income-based repayment, if they will get into that, it will help to protect them against the worst outcomes like defaulting on their loans, ruining their credit. It means that if they are find themselves in a job where they don't make enough money to pay their, you know, to pay off their loans, or if they are in fact unemployed and unable to make a payment, that those payments will not be collected on them. If they can stick with that for up to 10 years, a period of time I think is far too long, but nonetheless 10 years, then those loans will eventually be forgiven. So I think the real question is, how much are we going to help people get into the programs that can protect them again from the worst outcomes? And what sorts of coping strategies are people going to put into place so that, you know, while they limp along having not quite paid off their loans, they are still able nonetheless to make ends meet sufficiently so that they can live?
Illinois' budget situation and the MAP grant funding. And then when we look at the federal level, it's not, I'm not trying to be bleak, but do you have, it seems like things are going to get much worse for students who want to enter college.
I think they are. I don't think, I think the only thing that's going to change the situation right now is voting. That's all we can do. You know, there's really not, there's no convincing the folks who want to cut these programs. So I think that we just have to be very, very clear with our elected officials what will happen if they do. I don't know what else to do, to be honest. It's a very difficult time.
Yeah, and in response to that, I have a younger brother who is a sophomore in high school, so he'll be entering college 3 years from now. And 3 years from now, I feel like his situation is going to differ very greatly from mine. I feel like he's going to be in more debt than me, and it's going to be hard for him to pay off the tuition. So I'm really worried for him.
What are you telling him, Jean?
I'm telling him that he should really focus on bettering his grades so that he can apply to more scholarships than I did, and really think about the debt that he's going to accumulate, and that he should think smartly.
Wow. Yeah. Well, lots of families, I think, are in your situation, Jean, and lots of students as well. Thank Jean Kang. She's a recent graduate of the U of I. She graduated this year, the first in her family to go to college. And also Sarah Goldrick Rabb. She's a professor of higher education policy and sociology at Temple University. Jean, Sarah, thank you for taking the time to talk with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having
me.
Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. Last week, Governor Bruce Rauner called a special session of the Illinois General Assembly. Starting this Wednesday, state lawmakers will have 10 days to agree on a full budget, even though it's been 719 days since the last time legislators were able to get that done. As our elected representatives give it one more shot before Illinois enters its third year without a spending plan, we're joined by two political reporters to help us understand what's going on, as we do every Monday. Sarah Burnett covers politics for the Associated Press, and Dave McKinney is a political reporter for Reuters. Sarah and Dave, welcome back to the 21st.
Thanks, Brian.
Brian, thanks for having us.
Sarah, could you just explain to us what this special session is and why Governor Rauner decided to call for it?
Sure. So the new fiscal year will start July 1st, and if the legislature and the governor aren't able to agree on a budget by then, it will mark the third year in a row that we will be starting a fiscal year without a budget. So the governor essentially has called for them to return to Springfield on Wednesday and to stay every day until the end of June in an attempt to come together on a deal. He has some ideas in mind of what he would like to see, and the Democrats have a different thought.
Sure. Dave, is there anything about, you know, a special session that makes it any more likely that a budget will actually get passed?
No, not really. I mean, you know, I think it's more of a dose of political theater. You know, we saw under Rod Blagojevich, for example, I mean, I think during 1-2 year stretch, like between 07 and 09, he called for 27 or 26 special sessions to try to you know, prod the legislature into moving on budget changes, pension reform, you know, a construction project. And, you know, if the legislature is not a willing partner in whatever a governor wants to do, if there's not consensus between the two branches, these things tend to be, you know, really kind of an exercise in futility.
Sure. Could you want anything to add, Sarah?
I was just going to add that Governor Rauner himself in the past has said that calling a special session and going to Springfield, this was during previous budget years, that would be a waste of time, that didn't make sense to spend taxpayer money to have them all in Springfield doing that when the leaders hadn't been able to agree on something. This time around, he apparently felt that it would be a better move to call them there, and unclear what makes this not a waste of time this time compared with previously.
Sure. Democratic Senate President John Cullerton said Friday that the legislature doesn't need the governor to pass a budget. He then called on House Republicans to help pass a budget that could override a veto from the governor. Sarah, we saw something similar to this happen in Kansas, where Republicans and Democrats passed a veto-proof income tax hike, despite the fact that there was a Republican governor who disagreed. Any chance of something like that happening here in Illinois?
Not likely, no. The interesting thing to keep in mind about Kansas is that Republicans there were moved to act when they had hit a point of, I don't know the number off the top of my head of how much their unpaid bills or their backlog was reaching, but it was a tiny, tiny fraction of what's happening in Illinois. Now, the Republicans have signaled that they are on board with the governor. They introduced a plan that he says he supports, and that's what they want to do. I don't see them going along with the Democrats suddenly and breaking from the governor at this point.
Well, I mean, bear in mind, too, that just the numbers we're talking about are huge in terms of how many votes would be required, how many Republican votes would be required. You know, before the legislature ended its spring session, there was a House Democratic caucus where they surveyed members, Madigan surveyed members about, you know, what kind of appetite do they have for the revenue piece of this, what the Senate included in its package. And there were only 42 House Democratic members that supported that. And, you know, when we hit June 1st, we're in this mode now where in order for anything to pass and have an immediate effective date, there needs to be 71 votes. So what that means is there needs to be 29 House Republican votes to go along with those 42 votes. And that's just, you know, the equation does not work. You're not going to see 29 House Republicans break ranks with the governor or the House Republican leader to go along with Democrats on a revenue bill if there's not agreement out of the second floor office of Governor Rauner.
Sure. You know, and one major question that comes up with this is whether we'll finally see enough pressure to force lawmakers into agreement. We are starting to see some pressure build from a few different areas. Last week, Mega Millions and Powerball announced that they could stop participating in Illinois, which would hurt from the revenue side. We've also heard that the Department of Transportation could stop all new projects on July 1st. Dave, do you think lawmakers are starting to feel this increased pressure to pass a budget? And, you know, if you know, things that I just mentioned aren't enough, what are the pressure points here that could actually force a deal?
Yeah, I don't really think in terms of pressure there's anything new now as opposed to 3 weeks ago. I mean, I think these issues we're seeing flare up here with the road projects and the lottery. I think there's something that feels choreographed about them to me. I mean, I think the, you know, with road construction projects, of course, they don't rely on general revenue funds to, you know, to be built. I mean, you're talking about borrowed money, you're talking about federal money typically, and those things in the past have hummed along separate of any kind of budget problems. I mean, there needs to be appropriation authority, I understand, but that doesn't seem like it, you know, I don't fully understand why that's an issue. And then, you know, I've trouble getting a straight answer out of the state here since they lottery changes about whether this was truly dictated to them by the Multi-State Lottery Association, as the state has implied, or whether it's something that the state did on suspending these programs. Because, again, I am having trouble getting any sort of documentation out of the Multi-State Lottery Association or even the state saying that, you know, this consortium is telling Illinois you can't participate until you pass a budget. I'm not seeing proof of that.
Sure. You know, Sarah, one consequence of this crisis is that we've heard more and more from the state's controller. You recently wrote that Susana Mendoza said that the state's finances are in, quote, massive crisis mode, especially since some recent court orders related to the budget are forcing her office to pay more money than it has. Could you just kind of back up a little bit and explain to us how this impasse has affected the role of the controller?
Sure. So, essentially, there are certain categories of spending that the comptroller's office is either mandated or that it's a really, really good idea to make those payments. It's things like the money that they owe on debt and the pension payment. There's other things, continuing appropriations for different items. Of late, there's some ongoing court orders. There have been more handed down lately saying you must pay this. And so what she was saying basically is that the amount of things that she considers that she absolutely has to pay without a budget in place is now equal to the amount of money that the state is taking in. Now, keep in mind, you know, this has been going on for a while, that they just don't pay other bills or they become part of this now $15 billion backlog. The troubling thing is that among the items that are now considered to be, you know, we don't have to absolutely pay this right away, are things like school buses and some ambulance services. Really important things. But to Dave's point, you know, that hasn't been enough to move these lawmakers up to this point already. So I think Susana Mendoza, and she has been a very vocal critic of the governor, I think she feels a little bit like she's sort of screaming into thin air, like a lot of these social service providers and others who have been trying to push for an agreement.
Sure. And as you mentioned, Sarah, the courts have been in the news a lot this past week. A state appellate court in Chicago rejected a claim from social service agencies that they should, too, be paid by court order. Meanwhile, an appellate court in Mount Vernon heard arguments in a case that could overturn a previous order mandating that the state pay workers even without a budget. Dave, it could be a while until this case involving state workers is resolved, but how big of an impact could that case have on the budget impasse?
Well, I mean, it's another pressure. If paying state employees, if for some reason state employees were not being paid, that would be one of the pressure points here, where, you know, it would force some sort of resolution. I mean, you can't run a state if your prison guards, for example, are not being paid, and so, you know, that. But, you know, that could be months away before we see any kind of resolution to that. You know, I was going to make a point off of what, earlier, but the issue with the comptroller, I mean, there's a, I don't know if I would call it kind of a delicious irony or not. The idea that, because Rauner called these legislators back into special session, it means that the legislators are entitled to a per diem payment for their meals and their lodging of a little over $100 per day. And of course, you know, it means to a lot of these members, it's an important thing that they rely upon. Well, the fact is, you know, with the fact that Mendoza has no money to pay, you know, even the most, you know, basic of things, any kind of per diem that these guys get, they're basically at the end of the line. So it could be months or years before they get reimbursed for any kind of lodging or food that food costs they run into in the next 10 days.
Sure. And Sarah, the other pressure point that I hear that actually could force some kind of an agreement here would be if K-12 schools don't open this fall. And there's been chatter that, that most lawmakers don't really have an appetite to pass any kind of another stopgap agreement. So I think maybe that's more of a realistic possibility this year than it has been the past couple of years. Is that probably the other big pressure point other than state workers not getting paid?
They rely on property taxes, and so that's another stream of revenue that they can rely on while this state thing goes and goes and goes. I mean, I'd heard that probably about a month in to the school year, that's about the point when you would see maybe a dozen districts statewide starting to run into serious problems, and these are the most property poor school districts around the state, East St. Louis, North Chicago, for example. That would have serious problems in staying open. But broadly, if you're talking about suburban school districts, even downstate districts, Peoria, Springfield, places like that, they probably have enough in property tax revenues to be able to survive this for a good chunk of the school year.
Yeah, Sarah, any thoughts from you on that?
Some of these districts have money in reserve. So I don't think there's any or many districts that aren't going to open in August. The question is how long they can go. I mean, this is another of the Illinois issues swirling around, is this huge disparity in money that's available for schools. And so you, as Dave said, you would have schools in the suburbs that could go indefinitely. They've got a couple years worth of reserves. You've got poor rural districts in particular that have maybe a month.
Gotcha. All right. Well, before we wrap things up here, Dave and Sarah both. Sarah, I'll start with you. Where do you see negotiations on the budget at this point? Any signs of hope that there could be an agreement during these 10 days of special session?
Nothing that I've seen.
Dave, how about you?
Now, this is sort of like a 1,500-piece jigsaw puzzle with about 150 pieces missing. I don't think you're going to get a completed piece here by the end of the fiscal year, and I think we're just going to keep going into the foreseeable future without a budget.
All right, we'll leave it there for today. Dave McKinney, political reporter for Reuters. Sarah Burnett, politics reporter for the Associated Press. Thanks both of you for joining us today on the 21st.
Thank you.
For today on the show, you can always find past episodes on the NPR One app. Just search for the 21st, and we're also available on iTunes and Android. And if you have Alexa, we're easy to find. Just tell Alexa to ask NPR One to play the 21st. All those links, directions for Alexa, and every other way to contact us via phone, email, or social media is at our website, 21stshow.org. You can follow us on Twitter. Search for 21STShow. We live tweet during the show with more analysis and background about what we're discussing. On our Facebook page, search for the 21st to like us. You can comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments you want us to ask on air. We're produced by Christine Herman, Alan Montecelio, and Sean Newman. Megan Jones is our intern. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our executive director. Thanks to Joe Yun and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois' Social Media Analytics Lab for their research help, and special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. I'm Brian Moline, sitting in for Nyla Boodoo today. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks so much for listening.